Hopefully she doesn't meow through the whole thing.
Oh, it's fine if she does.
She's going to think I'm talking to her. But I'm sorry, okay. She's not too bad.
That's all right. So, Pastor Ricky, thank you so much for coming back, man.
Yeah, of course. My pleasure.
Yep. So last time we talked about suffering in a practical context, right?
Yeah, that was my goal, was to got pastoral theology, got understanding first so we could start with the practical. All right, you know, we can theorize about this all we want, but what does it look like? With the pastoral application, how it works and stuff. So yeah, tonight, look at my notes here. You know, I think I said it in the last episode, calling it a cerebral understanding, more of falling under systematic theology. And, there's a lot that you can look at systematically speaking, but there's only like, there's two things I want to talk about. It's because okay. You just keep going really deep down a rabbit hole so I think a good place to start, is actually, so, you know, we celebrated the Lutheran Reformation not too long ago, October 31st, right? Mm-hmm. October 31st, 1517, for the hearers who don't know, is, you know, the traditional dating of the start of the Lutheran Reformation, distinctive from the other reformations.
To give listeners a little bit of context, we are recording this episode on December the 2nd of 23.
Yes. Okay. Right before Advent. October 31st, 1517 marks the date that Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Wittenberg church doors, and therefore the start of the Lutheran Reformation. It's important. The 95 theses are really important, but I'm of the opinion with the Reverend Dr. Rick Mars that if you really want to understand Luther's early theology, you need to read his Heidelberg Disputation, which he wrote just a few months later in 1518. I want to say February, but I'm probably wrong about that. But it was only a few months later. And this is where we get the theology of the cross and the theology of glory from. And I know apparently there are some people who don't like that paradigm, but they're being ridiculous. it's very important to early Luther, but you even see it later in his writings. You can't really understand Luther's theology without these two distinctions, the theology of the cross and theology of glory. So, you know, we're not going to go through the entire disputation, and because that'd take forever, and there's a lot of important things to glean from those theses. But for our purposes, the main concern of Luther in the disputation is that our suffering is a continuation of Christ's suffering for us. That's kind of central to that disputation. As I said at the end of the previous episode on this, the point of our suffering is to bring us to Christ and his cross. And there's a lot of ways you can define the theology of glory and the cross, but I think the best way to define them is that the theology of glory asserts the Christian life is something we do. And the theology of the cross is that the Christian life is something done to us. And I'm grabbing this again from Dr. Rick Mars in his book, Making Christian Counseling More Christ-Centered. Have you heard or seen that book?
Mm-mm.
It's quite good. He says in there, the Christian life is a vita passiva, meaning a life that is happening to you. And that's really the theology of the cross. At least one way to define it, how I prefer to define it. So Dr. Mars makes the argument, I believe a valid argument, that Luther saw the theology of the cross as how we care for souls. And most people, especially prosperity gospel heretics, view suffering as evidence that God has removed the blessing from your life because of some secret sin you've committed, or you're not thinking enough positive thoughts, or whatever pagan magic mumbo jumbo they used. Job's friends, were theologians of glory. They kept trying to convince Job, oh, this must be some secret sin that you committed to be among the group of the wicked. So Luther did not view suffering that way. Luther viewed suffering in terms of 1 Corinthians 1:18. The word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. And this is why I wanted to save this for the second segment, because we talked about what the word of the cross is in the first segment. For those who are listening, if you haven't listened to the first episode where Remy and I talk about suffering, you should listen to that first before talking about this one.
Agreed.
Or listening to this one. But anyway, moving on. So theses 19 through 24 of the Heidelberg Disputation are where we find Luther's definition of the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. And theologians of glory are wrong because they focus on, Luther says, this is a direct quote, the invisible things of God, like virtue, godliness, wisdom, justice, goodness, and so forth. But instead, and we discussed this in the previous episode, God revealed himself not in these powerful and glorious things, but in suffering. In the incarnate Christ who suffered and died for us. Now, to the pagan world, this is folly, right? That's why you get unbelievers who find the gospel scandalous and heretics who want to throw the cross in the trash. They become theologians of glory because they want to move beyond the cross and get to God's glorious mind. Right, but and that's where you'll fall into theodicies, defenses of God, and God doesn't need our defense. But again, that's a rabbit trail that we won't head down. But they fail to realize that God's glory is both revealed and hidden in the cross. It's the power of salvation to we who believe. It's one of the awesome things about Lutheran theology, and you see it in scriptures all over the place, is the maintaining of paradoxes. There's paradoxes all over the place in our theology, but especially in the scriptures. Because Lutheran theology sees those paradoxes, and what we do is we don't try to do an either or thing, like, are you a saint or a sinner? It's both.
Right.
Both and, right? Saint and sinner. So the cross. Is God's glory revealed or hidden? Yes. Right? His glory is both revealed and hidden in the cross. Thesis 21 in the Disputation is really revealing. This is also a direct quote from Luther. He says, therefore, the friends of the cross say that the cross is good and works are evil. For through the cross, works are destroyed, and the old Adam, who is especially edified by works, is crucified. It is impossible for a person not to be puffed up by his good works unless he has first been deflated and destroyed by suffering and evil until he knows he is worthless and that his works are not his, but God's. Okay, so a couple things here. One, he says the friend of the cross says the cross is good and works are evil. At the end of the previous episode on this, I said that to reject the cross is satanic thinking. This thesis, I believe, reinforces that sentiment it's easy to say Luther is rejecting good works here, but no, you need to read the rest of Luther's corpus to understand that he doesn't reject good works insofar as they're done from faith for the good of our neighbor, right? Not in meriting salvation, which is what he's condemning in those words. Now, in your episode with Pastor Tyler Cronkite, you guys were onto something when you were saying, I don't know if you remember this, that Satan is really good at law and gospel. He just flips it around.
Yeah.
So, you know, like he says, if you really were a Christian, you would do this. And it's okay. You can go ahead and do that sin because God will forgive you anyway. Then when you indulge yourself, he says, you knew you weren't supposed to do that, but you did it anyway. Some Christian you are. Mm-hmm. How can God forgive you now? He purposefully twists and confuses law and gospel because he's a theologian of glory. He doesn't even want you to look at the cross, especially if it has Jesus on it. actually, I take that back somewhat. He won't mind that you look at an empty cross, but he doesn't want you to look at one with Christ on it because it'll bring you to say to him, okay, yes, I did those things even when I didn't want to, but look, Christ died for me. Get behind me, Satan. No, he doesn't want that. He wants you to look at your works, right, at yourself, to look within Luther called enthusiasm, right? Today we call it mysticism, hence the abomination that is contemporary worship. Anyway, so when we suffer, what's our initial reaction? I mean, there's multiple ways you can answer that question, but I think the basic fundamental thing is when we suffer, we tend to look at ourselves. My cat's being crazy. Can you hear that?
Sounded like she fell off of something.
She's just running around. All right. I think the fundamental thing of when we suffer is that we tend to look at ourselves. We look at our works. Like, oh, look at that stupid thing I did. I can't believe I did that again. I said I would do better, but I guess I didn't really mean it. Now I really mean it, right? And then rinse and repeat. Luther said, we forget this. Luther said that all of us are theologians of glory, and we should all strive to become theologians of the cross. Most of the time, when we suffer, we become theologians of glory because we don't look at the cross, but at ourselves. We become a theologian of the cross when we suffer and go to the cross, hence the previous segment, which is to go to Christ where he promised to be in his word and sacraments. His words, or actually word, because it's one word in Greek, it is finished, is pronounced over you in absolution. And, you know, in baptism, his words, today you will be with me in paradise, are washed over you. In the Lord's Supper, you receive his body and blood that were shed for you. So a theologian of the cross goes to his pastor when he suffers, who then brings you to Christ. So that's the first thing with that quote from Luther, that when he says works are evil. Not, you know, works in and of themselves, but insofar as you keep looking to yourself rather than to Christ. So the second thing that we should talk about that he says there, he says a person must be deflated and destroyed by suffering and evil until he knows he is worthless and that his works are not his but God's. So like most things Luther says, this can also be misunderstood. You know, he's not saying a person should be in a constant state of feeling worthless. No, that's depression. And we know Luther does not advocate for depression. What he's getting at is destroying the theologian of glory that's in all of us. Because as theologians of glory, we're always looking to our works and accomplishments and successful careers, especially our bank accounts, because it can tell us how successful or unsuccessful we've been. To become a theologian of the cross, we must see that all these efforts are worthless before God. So I guess by way of example, you know, I have my MDiv, And I might get my PhD or a doctor of ministry someday. I'm leaning towards the doctor of ministry. But these are worthless before God. Instead of looking at my degrees on the wall, I should look to Christ on the cross. That's what he's getting at. You know, I might have six figures in the bank. I don't, by the way. But, you know, these are worthless before God. Instead, I should look at the massive credit Christ paid into my spiritual bank account, which was, you know, infinitely bankrupt until he bled and died for me. Now, I can look at all the things I've done with my hands, but these are worthless before God. Instead, I should look at the hands that were nailed for me. I can look at how far I've walked in this life, how far I've come. But again, this is worthless before God. Rather, I should look at the feet that were nailed for me. Again, it's a paradox. When I see how worthless these things make me before God, I then see the insurmountable worth I have in Christ. When I see that Christ suffered and died for me, right? Your works are worthless. But Jesus did not die for worthless people. He died for the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son. You know, Luke 15. He died for you. Now, there was rejoicing at the end of each of those three parables in Luke 15. You know, so Jesus rejoices over you. So that's the first part of the cerebral understanding of suffering in a systematic way, systematic theology way. The second part, and this is the last part as well, is what's called God's proper work and alien work. Have you heard of that before?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know,
define it for us.
Yeah. God's proper work, you could say, is his modus operandi. It's his default. God's proper work is that he delivers his grace. God's alien work is that he will sometimes use suffering to bring you to his proper work, which we can also say is the work he does not want to do, but will do for your own good. The best way to describe this is to use the analogy of a doctor. And again, I have Dr. Rick Mars to thank for this, this analogy. It's from that same book I mentioned earlier. So he says the doctor's proper work is that she heals you. You know, that's the main thing she's supposed to do, is to heal you. Her alien work might be something like surgery. You know, before we started recording, you know, I said my wife was in had surgery on Wednesday. But that's like a year after three emergency surgeries she had last December. I think I talked about that in the last episode. So believe it or not, surgery is the last thing a surgeon wants to do. This is contrary to how surgeons are portrayed in TV shows like Grey's Anatomy, which it depicts them like these crazy people who are obsessed with cutting people open and will do whatever it takes to do surgery. Sure, in real life, surprise, TV doesn't portray real life. Surgery is the last thing a surgeon wants to do. It's the last resort. So sometimes it's the best thing for you in order to bring you to the doctor's proper work of healing you, which is literally what my wife is going through right now. She had surgery, and it was necessary to bring her to the doctor's proper work of healing. And they're suffering in that, right? The doctor literally enacted suffering on her. Getting, you know, cut open, you know, and the recovery phase is suffering. She's suffering quite a bit. But the purpose of that is to bring her to the proper work of healing. Going along with this analogy, similarly, when a patient has a terminal illness, the doctor does not want to deliver the bad news, but in order to do what's best for their patient, they will deliver the news to you and say, all right, here are the next steps we can take to help make you comfortable.
Right.
So, and then one last analogy we could use is the proper work of a police officer is to protect and serve the public. His alien work might include firing his weapon. Now, he does not want to fire his weapon, but he will in order to do his proper work of protecting himself as well as the public. To a lesser extent, a cop doesn't want to arrest someone, but they will in order to do their proper work of protecting the public. So, a better analogy would be to use a biblical example, Paul's thorn in the flesh. This is 2 Corinthians 12, 1 through 10, which I think I will actually read it. I forgot to pull my Bible out in front of me ahead of time, but smartphones are helpful. 2 Corinthians 12. Yeah, so this is 12, 1 through 10. I'll read it here. Just so everybody's familiar with all the context and everything.
Sure.
This is Paul. I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained by it. I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast. But on my own behalf, I will not boast, except of my weaknesses. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it, so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So, God's alien work in Paul was the thorn in his flesh, whatever that was. There's a lot of scholars make their speculations, but they're just that. Speculations, useless speculations. We don't know what it was, so we shouldn't waste time speculating on it. The point is, Paul was led to realize that the purpose of the thorn was to prevent him from becoming arrogant about the visions and revelations God was giving him.
Right.
Well, there's that disciplinary aspect to it. But more than that, it was to lead him to God's proper work, which he quotes Christ. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Remember, his proper work is to deliver his grace. And that's exactly what Christ did for Paul. So more than any practical reason for Paul's suffering, the grand purpose was to bring Paul to God's proper work of the grace of Christ, whose power is made perfect in us when we are weak. There's really no cerebral way to understand this other than to point the listeners back to our previous episode on suffering from a pastoral perspective. So again, listen to that. Through pastoral care, that strength of Christ in our weakness is actualized in his means of grace, which is the word and sacraments. So that's really it for the proper and alien work. at times God may allow you to suffer, like with Paul, this thorn in the flesh. Mm-hmm. And again, what's the purpose? There might be a practical reason, which you may or may not find out.
Right.
Paul was fortunate enough to figure out, oh, God doesn't want me to be conceited. But the main thing was to hear Christ's words, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And I'll just close with saying, there is no way to understand those words from Christ unless you experience suffering and therefore his grace in the midst of that suffering yourself. Yeah. I can give you as many words as I can, write as much poetry as I can and preach about it. But until you bear that cross and take that to the cross of Christ and his word and sacraments, can't really understand what he's getting, what all this means.
Yeah.
So I guess I said it's cerebral, systematic, not practical, but I think it was Dr. Joel Bierman who said all systematic theology is practical theology. So even with that, there is, you know, practical application with this understanding of, you know, the proper alien work of God. The purpose is to bring you to Christ and receive his grace in your weakness. So, yeah, that's what I prepared for tonight.
Amen.
Would you like to talk about anything, bring anything up?
No. Other than to say, if I could loop right back to the needless speculation on the thorn in Paul's flesh, yeah. I would like to say that some people say it's a sin, mm-hmm. Perhaps.
Could be.
And I disagree. I disagree with that because, like, I feel like it would be like, first off, I never hear anyone say that. For any reason other than to justify their own unrepentant sin, right? Yeah. This is my thorn in the flesh. Of course, I'm going to have another Coors Light tonight. It's my thorn in the flesh. No, you're a drunk, right? Get help. I don't like that. If it encourages someone to unrepentant sin, I just want to encourage the listeners. Unrepentant sin is not a thorn in the flesh.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, yeah, I have heard that as a common explanation that it's some specific sin. And I've even heard sexual sin that he was suffering with. And I'm just like, we don't know that. And
no.
And I agree with
him. If anything, I think it was blindness. I think he was going blind because it's very apparent throughout the rest of the epistles that he is, in fact, going blind.
Yeah. Also know he had a bad memory because in 1 Corinthians, he's talking about, he's dealing with the divisions of the people, you know, I follow Cephas, I follow Paul, I follow Christ. And, you know, Paul's just breaking all that down, like, stop dividing yourselves. And he's, you know, he says, God, I thank God that he didn't send me to baptize anyone, though I did baptize Stephanus and his household, but I forget who else I baptized, something like that. So
right.
He has baptized, but he doesn't remember who he's baptized. So bad memory. I don't know, some thing that, I mean, that something you just can't get rid of, you know, like,
yeah.
Depression.
Depression, that could be something.
That's just an example. I'm not saying he was depressed.
I will say, though, life. Suffering, suffering as there are certain kinds of suffering where you're not bearing your cross, right? Tim Lambesis of As I Lay Dying went to jail for 6 years, I think, of 9 or 8 years of 9, something like that. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. He got out for good behavior, got out early, but it was a murder for hire plot on his wife. He lost his faith. He started sleeping around while he was on tour, doing drugs, steroids, all kinds of stuff. And he mentioned to a workout buddy that he wished he could just get his wife out of the way. And that's it. Like, I think he asked the guy if he knew a hitman, right? And the guy immediately went to the sheriff's office and said, hey, a friend of mine wants to kill his wife and I think he's serious. And so they set up a sting and he gave this guy like gate codes and house keys and like 10 grand. And it was a sheriff's deputy. And he was like, make sure you do it while I'm on tour so that I'm not a suspect. And then he went to jail for that. Right. And that's, so that's not, he's not carrying his cross. He's not suffering, in a Christian way. Now, God did use that suffering to bring him back to the faith. Which is, you know, good, but like that's that there is a difference in just like consequence, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you know, we don't want to be suffering worshipers, but we don't want to deny the reality that it exists and the fact that God does use it for his good purposes, to bring you to the proper work of grace. I mean, Romans 8:28.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah. I mean, that can be kind of cliche at times, but it's the word of God. It's never cliche. So.
Oh yeah. But, no, I lean on that. That's like my life verse, dude. I love Romans 8:28.
So we don't want to be suffering worshipers. We don't want to seek it out. You know, the apostolic fathers, you know, cautioned the people about that, about don't seek martyrdom. Yeah, it's, you know, gives God glory. But don't be an idiot and seek it out. But yeah, we don't want to deny it or try to use self-medication methods to get away from it.
Right.
You know? Because everybody, I mean, you look at our culture and everybody's just trying to get away from suffering. And the reality is you can't get away from it.
Never.
We live in a sin corrupted world. Suffering is inevitable. But the good news is that God the Son, you know, suffered not just for you, but with you.
Yeah.
You know, whenever we talk about Christ's suffering, we tend to limit it to his passion. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, his passion is like the crux of all human history. But I always teach my people that, you know, Christ, when he became human, the fact that Christ was human was to suffer. By being human, Christ suffered. So, you know, he stubbed his toe. He suffered indigestion. Now, he was a carpenter. Who knows how many times he hammered his nail? He was so exhausted on the Sea of Galilee that he slept through a windstorm. I've been on a canoe in a windstorm on a huge lake. I know what that's like. That's terrifying. So we tend to kind of downplay or kind of make fun of the disciples for being terrified. Like, don't they know that the Son of God is with them? It's like, dude, have you ever been in a windstorm?
Okay. To be fair, though, Jesus dunked on him the exact same way.
Yeah, he did. He did. That's true. But still, I mean,
like, that was the first thing. It's like the first thing he said was like, Peter, I'm on the boat.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe there was some foolishness to it, but I think more than foolishness, they were human.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be terrified? And because they're human, why wouldn't they be foolish? And if I were on the boat and I believe that this is the Son of God, I probably still would have been terrified because I'm a human, which means I'm an idiot. So, I forget the point I was getting at, but I forget what I was going to say, but yeah. So, not ignoring suffering, trying to escape from it because you can't, but there is one who did escape it. Literally by conquering death. And, you know, the word and sacraments are the elixir to that. And what I had also said in the previous episode about having your Simon, or Simon of Cyrene, or more than one Simon, to help you bear your cross. So Jesus received help from Simon to bear his cross. And it was temporary, right? Simon didn't die with Christ until he was baptized. He was a believer, so I'm assuming he was baptized. But anyway. So yeah, having the Christian brethren, or a brother or a sister, to help you bear that cross.
Amen. Pastor Ricky, thank you so much.
Yeah, you betcha.